Good evening, and welcome back to the Ushers of Horror. I'm Paolo.
I'm Koza.
I'm Axa.
And you are the faithful listeners. So we've made it to part three of our three-part review special, where we've been covering so far Vivarium and St. Maud. And without blowing our own trumpets, I thought the past two episodes have been pretty juicy, actually. Mm. So we've actually covered a lot and like in quite a succinct amount of time.
I like the use of the word juicy.
So I hope you guys have enjoyed these episodes as much as we have. And who knows, we could do a few more. We could get into a trend of doing specials now. How are you guys? How's your day, evening been? Because we're currently, it's like 10:30. We're having a nice...
Is it 10:30 already? Wow. Evening. How the time flies.
It's more fun. I quite like doing that at this time. It's a bit more...
spooky.
I don't know. Our cover was spooky.
Late night recordings.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
I mean, you look like you have a proper vibe going on in your room. You've got like purple lights.
Oh shit, yeah, it was a lockdown purchase. I can get them all like...
Those are bisexual lights.
Bisexual
lights. Have you read about that recently? Like, it's been blowing up on film Twitter. Apparently purple lights in film, it means bisexual lights.
Oh, I've seen that.
Well, as in the lights themselves are bisexual.
You think bisexuals are about in the film. If you see purple lights in a film, you know something bisexual is going down.
What's the term for that in film?
I honestly think it's just called bisexual lighting.
No, where you use like certain colours and moods, like specific colours that represent certain things.
Okay, like connotations and things.
Yeah, but it's called, there's a certain word for it. It's going to hurt me.
But I'm trying to think on like... On the rainbow flag, you know, on the pride flag. I'm sure like...
Apparently, the simultaneous use of pink, purple, and blue lighting to represent bisexual characters.
Huh. God damn. Interesting. See, this is what this podcast is here for. Because I do feel film can touch on, you know, in terms of like art, it can really touch on a lot of things other art forms can't. You know, film can include like still images, music, audio effects, and visual effects, all in like a movie.
Stop motion,
yeah.
CGI,
and even, you know, you look during the 30s and 40s, you know, a lot of filmmakers would use like Freudian and Jungian imagery in their films to hint more at character psychology.
I think it's one of the main parts of cinema is to do those kind of things. I think that's why I first liked film in the first place, was the way it looked, aesthetics, like costume, set design. I always thought that was a great part, because even if you're not concentrating on a film, you know, you're not really listening to it, but you're just watching it zoning out. It can be a pretty
film.
The images
keep you captured, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think I'm a visual learner.
100%.
That's how I like to look at things.
100%. Stuff like Dario Argento movies, Mario Bava films, they're so visually striking. Like, it doesn't really... Like, those films are kind of designed not to make sense. And they work. They totally work.
Who's the Alejandro Jodorowsky?
Oh, yeah.
His films are an acid trip. And visually, like, the first time I watched... What's his most famous one?
Is it El Topo or... The Holy Mountain.
First time I watched Holy Mountain, I was like, doesn't make sense.
Not a clue. Not a clue.
But it's so good to look at. Second time I watched it, I was like, this is a whole narrative. It's structured. It means something. There's actually depth to this. There's shit going on. But the first time I watched it, I was obviously, you know, blazed. And I just enjoyed looking at it, because it was just so confusing and fucked up and theatrical. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, right, I'm going to...
Actually, yeah, study it kind of thing.
And you learn so much more.
It's true. It's, you know, I remember, like, we used to have, like, really crazy parties, and, you know, we're doing loads of stuff, and we'd have in the background, like, Suspiria. Or, oh, God, what else were we used to play? Irreversible, which was a really bad idea. You could sit there and you could kind of study the film, you know, you can understand it in a deeper level, you know, and the images keep bringing you back to it.
When, in my first year at uni, me and my friend for a house party, and I think her course mate introduced us to Tetsuo.
The Iron Man.
Tetsuo the Iron Man. Yeah, and that just played the entire night at Halloween on a projector. And it was just so, like, vivid and horrible, and everyone was like, what the...
Because it's almost like montage stuff as well, you know, near the end, where it's just like really fast flash frames, like metal and things. That's a good film. I haven't seen the second one. I know they've done a couple.
I feel like it's the same. I feel like in the first film, like, there's no dialogue. There's maybe, like, three words spoken and the rest of the dialogue is just screaming.
Yeah, like, industrial music.
That's it.
You know, almost like, you know, every sort of student's final year. You know, it does feel like that. You know what I mean? It's very DIY, kind of cyberpunky. This is our final episode of this series, of this special, I should say.
Aww.
And this week, we're going to talk about a movie, I think, much like the other films we've discussed, is all about subtext and ideas. And that film is... La Llorona. However, not the Blumhouse movie, which we were talking about earlier. I've not seen. I can't remember if you guys said you've seen it.
I haven't seen it. I thought it was like a really good film comes out one year and another production house will be like, I'm going to make a cheaper version of it. And, like, more exciting, so you guys watch this one instead and, like, put it up on YouTube, like, put it up high on Google so it comes up first. That's what I was like, I'm not going to watch it.
Well, the Curse of La Llorona is the sixth installment in the Conjuring series by James Wan. He hasn't directed this one, but stars Linda Cardellini. And I think that's more of just like a standard Hollywood horror film.
Well, you know how we feel about Blumhouse this year, so...
Yeah, they've been... they've let us down a bit, which is a shame. Because hit the nail on the head, they really do it well. But no, I heard The Curse of La Llorona was much like The Nun. A lot of quiet, bang, quiet, jump scare sort of...
Quiet, none. But what's The Nun do?
Well, The Nun basically does a Marilyn Manson impression and goes, woo, nun.
Fair. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, I'm sure, you know, it's got some enjoyment factor to it. But that's not what we're doing today.
No, we're doing a film that has got nominated for the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film. It's currently on the shortlist at the Oscars for Best Foreign Language Film, along with 15 other films. I think the nominations for the Oscars come out on Monday.
As in this Monday?
Next Monday, yeah. So we'll know if it actually was nominated. From quite an esteemed director in Guatemala. So this film is far more serious than The Curse of La Llorona.
Even by the title, I think.
Yeah. We make it more camp or something.
A little bit, a bit more schlocky.
Schlock, schlock, schlock!
Schlocky.
Much like we've done in the past two episodes, so we'll spend the first part of the review talking about the context, the way it was made, behind the scenes sort of thing. And then, as always, we'll put in an alarm, a warning, a spoilers warning. And then it's up to you guys if you want to carry on watching. If you've not seen the film, I would recommend going back and watch it. And then give us a listen back.
Rated X.
Lo que se quedó atrás está atrás. No penses en eso. Que no te afecte.
Los sirvientes se quieren ir. Todos tienen miedo.
Este encierro nos está enfermando. Mi papá a ti te contaba todo.
Te prohíbo pensar eso.
Es una invasión. ¿Cuándo nos irán a dejar en paz?
¡Ah!
arriva al quarto che carità. Lo ci lo ca, cuscia. Scocca giù ci lì. Sciocchiacca.
So that was the trailer for La Llorona, directed by Jairo Bustamante, who also directed Volcano in 2015 and Tremors, also in the released same year earlier in 2019. Quick synopsis of this film. An aging paranoid war criminal, protected by his faithful wife, faces death while being haunted by the ghosts of his past. But using his own production company, La Casa de Production, this film came out in 2019, first at the Venice Film Festival. It's in Spanish and Mayan, and like we said earlier, was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film. Normally, we don't really do this, but I think it's quite important for the context of this film to know just about the history of Guatemala. This film is based on the genocide in Guatemala, and there was a civil war, and also a popular folklore legend of La Llorona that's popular throughout Latin America. And I thought, Paolo will talk about the folklore in a minute, but I thought I'd just quickly run down the history of Guatemala, which inspired this film itself. I hope I don't lose anyone at this point. I don't bore anyone.
No, I'm interested.
So it's important too. I think it's very important.
Because it's a big part of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 1960 to 1996, the government of Guatemala had a civil war with various leftist rebel groups. These groups were supported by ethnic Maya indigenous peoples and Ladino peasants, who together make up the rural poor. The government forces have been condemned for committing genocide against the Maya population of Guatemala and for widespread human rights violations against civilians. The context of the struggle was based on long-standing issues of unfair land distribution of European residents and foreign companies such as the American United Fruit Company that had dominated control much over the land and conflicting with the rural poor. The term Banana Republic itself describes a politically unstable country with an economy dependent on the exportation of a limited resource product such as bananas or minerals. This term was coined by American author O. Henry in 1904 to describe Honduras and neighboring countries because of exploitation by US corporations such as United Fruit Company. The United Fruit Company now goes today by the name of Chiquita, and you'll see their little logo on many bananas sold throughout the UK. So after you hear about this, you want to avoid those bananas and this company at all costs. I'll go earlier from give more context even before the Civil War, though. Basically, the Guatemalan society was made up of three distinct classes. The Criollos, who were a minority of descendants of Spaniards who conquered Central America. By 1920, they made up all members of political parties and the elite in the country. And the second class were the middle class, the Ladinos, who are descendants of peoples of indigenous African and Criollo ancestry. They had almost no political power, but they made up the bulk of artisans, storekeepers, tradesmen, and mine officials. And then the third class, which is the majority of the population of native indigenous Guatemalans, most of who were Mayans. Many had little to no formal education, and many natives served as soldiers for the army. In 1931, a general named George Ubico came to power, backed by the United States. A self-identified fascist, supporter of Hitler and Mussolini. He gave away hundreds of thousands of hectares of land to the United Fruits Company and exempted them from taxation and allowed the US military to establish bases in Guatemala. In Guatemala, a form of debt slavery and forced labor was implemented to make sure that the country had enough labor for coffee plantations and that the United Fruit Company had workers readily available. In 1944, Ubico resigned from office amidst a general strike and nationwide protests. And then democratic elections and a revolution between 1944 and 51 had brought popular leftist governments to power. 1952, a decree was passed, Decree 900, as it was known, and it redistributed unused land greater than 224 acres or 0.9 kilometers in area to local peasants, compensating landowners with government bonds. This, however, threatened the interests of the land-owning elite and mainly the United Fruit Company. And given the strong ties of the United Fruit Company with the US government, the Eisenhower government at the time, who had two cabinet ministers, brothers John Foster Jules and Alan Jules, who were the Secretary of State and the CIA director at the time. They both served in the company board. And so they had lobbied for the government to start a coup. But then they backed a right-wing army colonel, Carlos Castillas, to lead an insurrection in 1954, Guatemalan coup d'etat. Then following that, the new government began to dissolve a decade of social and economic reforms, banned labor unions and left-wing political parties, disenfranchisement of left-wing Guatemalans. He also returned all the confiscated land to the United Fruit and the elite landlords. A series of military coups followed around this time, and featuring fraudulent elections, which only military personnel were the winner candidates. And this led to the start of the civil war that would last from 1960 to 1996. However, between 1981 and 1983, a genocide occurred, and what was known as the Silent Holocaust or the Mayan Genocide. An estimated 200,000 people died in the civil war, with at least 40 to 60,000 estimated dying in this period, with countless more persons disappeared. The military had carried out 626 massacres against the Mayan population, and the Guatemalan army acknowledged destroying 440 Mayan villages between 1981 to 1983. Most of the civilian casualties were women and children, and an estimated 5% of indigenous population was wiped out. In 1999, the president of the country apologized for the atrocities of the war. But in 2012, the president of the time, Otto Molina, denied that there had been a genocide in Guatemala, arguing that it was impossible due to the large portion of the army being indigenous. However, a UN fact-finding mission found that genocide did take place. The film, one of the characters, is very much based on a general named General Efrain Rios Montt, who came to power in 1982, and he had overseen the bloodiest part of the war. In 2006, a Spanish court had issued an international arrest warrant for him. And in 2013, he was convicted of genocide and crimes against humanity. He was sentenced to 80 years in prison, becoming the first head of state to be convicted for genocide in a court in their own country. However, 10 days later, the country's constitutional court overturned the decision and in 2015 declared him unfit to stand trial. And in 2018, he died under house arrest, and the government of the time lamented his death as a tragedy. Till this day in Guatemala, there still hasn't been a true reparation and reconciliation of the genocide. Still, governments deny its role. Many people still haven't faced justice. And so that is what inspired this film. Paolo is now going to talk about the folklore of La Llorona.
Yes, sure, sure. That was good. I didn't know a lot of that. That's quite powerful. Especially, I think, after watching it.
I can't believe they still haven't recognised that there's been a genocide.
The general died at like 91 as well, to add insult to injury. This guy lived long after probably we will.
He was
Henry Kissinger. In the Congress. No, real evil men live. Yeah. They live.
He was in the Congress in the 2000s, and it was granted immunity during that time. So even up into the 2000s, he was in the government.
He tried to rerun, didn't he, a few times? Or tried to reinvent him?
Yeah, he did try to run as president again unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm. I thought you meant run away. Mm-hmm. This guy was running for president. That's crazy.
Confident.
And even today, really even crazy. Though the census says that 50% of the country are mixed, only 40% claim to be Mayan, just Mayan only. But many people think that number is way higher, but Mayans themselves are embarrassed or scared to self-identify as Mayan. Because
of the stigma around it,
throughout the time in Guatemala, that Mayans have been seen as subhuman.
That's so sad. That's so sad. Yeah, this is really good to know for the context of the film.
After reading up about it, but we'll get to it when we rate the film. But yeah. So hopefully, leading as well on as Kozan did, I'm going to discuss very briefly the legend itself of La Llorona. So, variations of the legend exist. However, there are a few common similarities between all of them. These are firstly that she is a ghost and a mother who is always weeping because she drowned her children. The reason for drowning her children are linked to the emotional turmoil over a secret love affair she had with a higher ranking male in society. Now, variations again exist on this fact, where the husband either wanted the children for himself to marry another woman and forget about the children, or murder the children himself. La Llorona took it into her own hands to drown the children. After she kills her children, God curses her to walk the earth for eternity, constantly weeping and searching for her children to gain access back into heaven. Anyone unfortunate to hear her weeping is usually drowned by her. She will also sometimes lure children and try to pass them off as her own, trying to trick God and enter back into heaven. Chilatula is considered to be the first woman in the world of the Aztecs and represents motherhood and is the fertility goddess. Usually considered by historians to be the first manifestation of the idea of La Llorona, where in Aztec mythology she is usually seen weeping or carrying a cradle and is usually seen disappearing into a body of water. Funnily enough, or weirdly enough, in Aztec mythology, women who die in childbirth are considered godlike in the idea that they died in the same pain as men did in battle, and in Mayan beliefs is the only way a woman could get into heaven. However, again, quite twisted, instead of coming back as a positive spirit, they're known as night ghosts, and it's the idea of the feminine mystique coming back to haunt the night. Myth began with the Aztecs and the Spanish conquistadors, and La Llorona is still in the public lexicon of Mexico today. And the myth has now become a symbol of defiance against male domination and a female icon who is quite literally taking on a mythical status. The empowerment aspect comes from, throughout the years, she's been seen more as a symbol of beauty and female empowerment and power while fighting against male tyranny. And the legend is also quite a favourite among parents who tell the tale to usually frighten children into behaving. And usually historians will break up into two different aspects of this. One is called encutramento, which means first-hand original accounts of people who have seen or have somehow been touched by the ghosts. And historia means how the legend of La Llorona came to be. And again, I feel the film does touch upon the idea of the past sins meeting up with the future, and this idea of, again, first-hand accounts of the ghost and how the ghost is coming to be, mixing up the real history of what Kozan and you were talking about and how these two things interplay and kind of create this meta frisson of that's happening within the film, where, like I said, when we get onto spoilers, there are certain scenes that actually mirror real life in terms of the real history and how it affects the characters in the film in a broadly historic sense. So, what did you guys think of the film? I was expecting words to come out. And nothing
I don't know why I went silent there. I really liked it. I was like, ah, I'm going to say something amazing. And I was like, yeah, it was really good. No, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was like, it's the first time I've heard, I don't know how to pronounce the language.
You could just say Mayan, but there's two variations of Mayan in the film. One is called, I actually wrote it down, Ixi, and the main one in the film is called Cachiquel.
This is the first time I've heard it in a film, which I thought was amazing. It was like first time sort of seeing a Guatemalan film. I didn't really know much about the film even like before I watched it, but I just loved the way it looked. The opening scene is just terrifying, even though it's just a bunch of women praying. I don't know if that's a spoiler. I don't know if it's in the trailer or not.
But it's not really a spoiler.
It just the way it displayed horror in a really, again, in a confined setting. It's sort of based in one home. You know, we're all stuck at home. So it sort of plays with the idea of like how you can just feel not safe, not safe in your own house, but like horrors of your own house. I don't know. That's how it kind of felt like to me as well. Like, because it's about this fascist military guy who's haunted by all the things he did, and he's stuck at home because he's, you know, waiting trial. So it's always like him stuck at home. He's just like, is my house haunted or is it not haunted? Like, what's going on? Is he imagining these things? Is it really happening to him? And it just, like, the way it plays with everything in the house, I think is, yeah. I think that's what I realised after watching the film.
I hear what you're saying, though. It makes sense. I sort of agree. The film really builds tension in a... There's a certain technique they use where the camera slowly pans out to reveal what's happening. Opening scenes is a great example. And it just builds tension because you know intrinsically, as an audience member, you're watching a horror film. And it just kind of really draws out this tension and doesn't usually descend into jump scares either. So it knows how to crank up tension and atmosphere. The cinematography, like you were saying, visually, it's really amazing. And again, you know, the through the cinematography itself brings up themes of isolation, paranoia, claustrophobia, this kind of unescapable, you know, almost this unescapable fate. Because the film, I guess, jumped back in time, sort of thing. It's not, I don't think it's a spoiler, but...
I think the filmmaker said, it was like inspired by The Shining as well, because The Shining and because they're trapped in one place, and it's sort of like how this within the space that you're in sort of like makes you a bit crazy. Like I'm sure in Guatemala, all of these people were told this horror story as kids, like Kozan said. As you said, Paolo. So when you're in fear of your life, when you're in fear of these things, like most people, like when they're nearly dying, they like turn to God. Maybe the latter will turn to the horrors that they were told when they were younger. So he's like reimagining all of these, like, you know, also linked with his whole history of like what he did.
No,
and
I
stuff.
Agree. I agree.
Apparently, the director Diaz like relied a lot on natural lighting in the film as well, and like played a lot with like camera tricks and like sort of like not using too much extra complicated techniques to film all these shots.
So he gave an interview with RogerEbert.com and the director. Gyro Bustamante, and he was asked why he used the horror genre to tell this story, and he said he was doing research and analysis on Guatemalan moviegoers, and apparently 90% of movie audiences in that country are watching either superhero blockbuster films or horror movies. So based on that, he started researching how to tell this story in the horror genre, and he came to the La Llorona folklore that he wanted to use for to tell this story of genocide. But in this film, he turns her really more of a terrifying heroine. But in this film, he's utilized her as a sort of an Avenger type character. And
she's a representation of like the trauma that the country suffered.
Removing the misogynist aspects of the folktale. Of what a woman crying out for a man, and in this it's turned into something much more relevant. She's crying for the suffering of an entire people, and he's transformed her into a Mother Earth type figure crying for her missing children. Similarly, this film is it's told in the perspective of the genocidal dictator, and his house is interpreted as the house of the devil. And normally he says we know stories of the victims, but we don't know how the devil lives inside his home, how he apologizes for what he did, and how he tries to keep his heroic facade. And also he says about this genre, he says, as he's talking about the horrors in his country and how people don't want to talk about the genocide committed in his country, people don't want to look for solutions. And he says, when that's the reality you are facing, what can you hold on to? You can hold on to magical realism. You can hold on to deities. You hold on to ghosts. You hold on to otherworldly things that can help you survive. And he says, this is why once La Llorona came to us, everyone came together and we could dedicate ourselves to creating. So it's a really interesting perspective of how he landed on the horror genre and how he chose this particular folklore to tell his story. To tell the story of genocide in his country and justice, or the misuse of justice, how the brutal dictator can get away with genocide, and how his country still don't want to reckon with what actually happened to the indigenous people.
Especially how like she becomes this sort of like powerful woman, like representing sort of like the pain and trauma that all the women in Guatemala must have faced during the genocide. Like you said, women and children were killed. And even the curses about this woman like losing her children and stuff. So the pain that the mothers feel and like all of that, it's just like, she's almost like, she kind of is a badass super horror film character, but in a really, really spooky, dark, artistic way.
Well, she's almost like, you know, the Western idea of La Llorona to some extent is, like the Gaia archetype, you know, Mother Earth in like pagan tradition, and the idea of bringing order to chaos. And I guess her sort of character arc is that, in a sense, bringing order to chaos by the end of it, in like a historical and social, like linear way. I've always thought that horror is such a great way to create metaphors about things. You know, you even look at David Cronenberg films where it's like plastic, you know, they're like visual metaphors. And this film, I think, is kind of a visual, like conceptual metaphor for a lot of... I'd really like to hear a film critic or someone in Guatemala thinks of this film and how they reacted.
Or even how the public reacted to the film, like how they must have felt like being Guatemalan or even being a citizen then, like going to watch that film. And I'm sure everybody knows about the genocide, whether you're like you're a believer or non-believer, it's going to bring up emotions. Like, we watched it like, right, this is deep, but like maybe knowing more of the history, even being part of the history, going to watch that in the cinema must have, or at home, I don't know. I definitely would have cried. That's really heartbreaking. Especially like you're seeing it from his perspective and you're kind of like, you don't want to give him any sympathy, but you see his wife throughout the film be so supportive and you're like, he's evil. Do you know that? Like, do you know what he's done? And even his daughter, who seemed like, it's just strange. But, you know, like every mother will protect their son, even if they're a murderer type vibe. Like,
the rest of the episode will contain spoilers for La Llorona. So, if I were you, and I would highly recommend it, go and watch La Llorona on Shudder, and then come back and finish the episode. Thank you for the love, people.
Let's spoil the whole film.
Okay, spoil the whole film. The family are, like, slowly breaking down. Like, the more, like, La Llorona... Well, you know, so, you know, La Llorona shows up. Because they're stuck, the family is stuck in the house because there's a riot, but there's like a massive protest, yeah, outside the house. Okay, cool. So they're under house arrest, and he sees is it Eugene? What's his name in the film?
Eugene? There's nobody called Eugene in the film, man.
The main guy, the dictator guy.
Yeah, he might actually be called Luigi. I'm joking. What is his name? Yeah, Enrique.
It sounds more like it. Enrique, okay. So Enrique is looking out the window and he sees what the audience kind of knows is La Llorona. And the guard let her in. There we are, Alma. She sees Alma. She comes in and the guard let her in and it's announced that she's the new nanny. Because the other staff have left out of fear because there have been some odd sightings.
But they know what's up, and you know they know what's up when they want to leave, but they don't want to say it out loud because they're like, this dictator is not going to understand us, and he won't believe us. We're just going to leave.
Yeah.
They don't want to believe it. And also, it's interesting that he chose the perspective of the dictator, like, not necessarily the victim, but the oppressor. And, like, I think one of the camera techniques they use, they actually, like, do you know the scene where Alma sort of is like luring him down into the basement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They like strap the camera like onto his chest and like slowly like bring him through. So like the whole thing, like you said, like instead of, what was it, used to be like a woman like searching for a man, like in this film, he was just like, she's luring him in, like she's set up all of these plots to like sort of like where she stands outside the house in the first place, like within the crowd, and she stares directly at him. She sort of like is always like basically playing mind games with him the entire film, trying to lure him into this sort of like curse and like really try to like basically scare the shit out of him and kill him.
Pretty much. Because we as an audience know what's going on. They know. It's just everybody else doesn't know. And it's very rare in a film where the small amount of characters knowing what's happening is what makes a big difference, which I thought was a really nice like change on the genre cliche. The scene you were talking about when she's luring him down the stairs, and that when she's in she's in the bath and she's like topless and she's washing herself.
Yes.
And then he turns the light on and he's standing there with like a boner, and I was like, that's really disturbing. that single shot didn't. I don't think I'd ever.
I didn't know it's the boner. That's fucked. Yeah. That's really mad.
It really unsettled me. There was something really like disturbing about it. And I thought that there's been a very long time since I've seen like just a single image that really made me really deeply uncomfortable. But even like shock tactic aside, it's just a wonderfully conceived film. You know, it's what I think like horror can do at its finest. I think what we said earlier, you know, like David Cronenberg made like visual metaphors, and Clive Barker with Hellraiser. It's about This is done on more of like an intellectual level as opposed to a physical thing. Where...
And it's not like heavy, gory stuff. It's just like playing with like costume and like light and just, you know, camera tricks and stuff like that. And it's just done
simply
really nice.
Done
yeah,
too.
Simply done with really nice touch. And he like, it's crazy that he did his research about like what people are actually going to watch. Like he's not an egotistical director that's like, I'm making my film and I'm making it my way. He's like, what do people want to see? How can I get this message across? Like, you've thought about people. That's really sweet.
Yeah, that's true. It's a film for the people, almost like by the people, for the people. You know, it's, I guess it's, again, as an audience member, if you were coming from Guatemala, that's almost like, you know, a collective lived experience on screen. Yeah. I guess almost like maybe if you were Guatemalan, it would almost be like a dark superhero film in a way. It'd be quite interesting, actually.
Do you know what scene I really, really loved and found really eerie? The bit where they're at the hearing in court and they have an old, obviously, like, indigenous woman, and she's like telling her story about like what's happened and talking about rape and all this stuff. And she has that beautiful blue veil over her with the gold embroidery and like the hand. I was just like, and then you look closer and it's just like this old, I'm really sorry to say this to this old woman because I know she's probably someone's grandma, but she looked fucking terrifying. And it's like a slow camera out, and she's just like, that was really scary for me. I don't know why they did that.
The cinematography
really
well. In it takes its time, you know, like you're saying, it draws out the tension and makes kind of everyday things quite scary. And again, you know, it kind of, it's quite claustrophobic. You know, there's scenes where near the beginning where he hit the taps on. Actually, 2 points, like the, you know, he hears the tap and the camera just slowly pans out of the shadows and you just see the outline and it just builds up so much tension. And secondly, I thought he was the main antagonist with the context of the real history. I feel the La Llorona character isn't really the main villain. You know, the real antagonist is...
Enrique. Yeah, totally. Because it's like, it's his own reckoning with what he's done. And it... I almost feel like it does touch not on, like, sexual abuse in the film as well. And, like, even at that bit where, like, you know, Alma's just wearing her normal uniform. And obviously after the scene where, like, Enrique, like, follows her down and is just, like, watching her have a bath. And he gets caught by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And even, like, his wife talks about his past and how he used to, like, rape and sleep with other women and she was kind of okay with it. Or no, like, he would just lie and be like, oh, there's other women there, but other people do it, I do it, I don't do it. But what was really going on was these soldiers were, like, not having relationships with these women.
Mass raping these villagers.
Mass raping these women. Mm-hmm. And they, like, ask Alma to, like, wear a baggier uniform because he can't control himself. And, like, all of these, like, weird sexual abuse references, it's just really, yeah, it's really fun.
And there's even questions if the head maid is his daughter.
Yeah, his, like...
That's right.
His daughter from an alleged, like, from a person that he had.
Yeah, the mother tries to make many justifications in her head that these women tempted them or these men are still men at the end of the day. Mm. The daughter's trying to have conversations with her and she was like, I remember you crying all the time when he went off to war because you knew that was women at these bases he would sleep with. She's obviously not okay with it, but she's made mental gymnastics in her head for... that her husband has put her through.
It's like it's the only way that she could cope, and she's almost sort of like conditioned herself to, like, you know, not see the real horrors. And, like, I mean, he's the only one seeing it, but, like, it slowly become, like, starts to become apparent to her that, like, it's not just these women that are affected by it. Like, maybe she's being affected by it now as well. I mean, I think that's her progression as a character through the film. Like, near the end, she gets scared.
Mm.
Yes, yeah. Because even she is the real victim of the film. You know, I remember the conversation after the hearing and the mother and the daughter are sitting in an empty room. They're whispering and they're, you know, the mother's trying to justify it. The daughter's trying to still see the fact that he's her dad, though he's really struggling. And, you know, the I can't remember the line, but it was basically something along the line of you'll eventually see through it sort of thing. This idea, you know, the trauma... lying for her genocidal husband has caused a completely massive rift.
Mm.
Such a good scene where it's just the mum and the daughter talking, like, while the trial's going on, and the mother in her head saying, oh, they're just a bunch of communists that died.
She's
she's also trying to say, oh, the country must move on anyway, the country must move on. and these women are liars, and the daughter saying
it's a genocide,
and the daughter saying that these aren't lies. This is, someone has to have gone through this to tell stories.
She calls them prostitutes. She says they're all prostitutes because that's the story her husband spun, and it's literally like it's just part of like. You know,
but I think she knows it's a lie. I think that's the thing that tears her up.
It's sad, but like it's the only way to make her believe, and it's just part of like rape culture. Be like, yeah, no, it's cool. We're just doing this. You know, no, it's you women. It's all this. Don't worry about it. We're just, you know, having fun. And she's been conditioned to believe that you're right. She is the victim. It's really sad.
But he talks about this. The three generations in the film of basically the three generations in Guatemalan society today. So the father, who's a dictator, former dictator, and the wife, the grandmother, they are the first generation that lived through the genocide. They were adults during this time. They knew what happened. They saw what happened. And these people don't want to acknowledge what's happened. They don't want to find solutions for what happened. Many of those people are still in power today. Many of those people, same people that were in power during the genocide, are still in power today. They still have the same political power, which is crazy. And then there's Sabrina, who's the daughter of the doctor in this film. She represents the generation that were growing up, that were children during this. Most of these people, even though they acknowledge, they know what's happened, they don't have the courage to speak out. They still live in fear. They keep it quiet. They know what's happened. And it's almost like the liberals in today that like understand racism is a bad thing. And they talk against it, but they don't talk against their families. They don't make big political gestures, but they understand.
Yeah, it doesn't affect them. So they don't.
And then there's the final generation, the granddaughter, who was open to Alma, who was friendly with Alma. And he's saying he's hopeful that this generation will be the generation to make a change.
Yeah, and it's really sweet throughout the film, the relationship of Alma and the little girl, because, like, it's so pure and innocent, and she just sees Alma as, you know, this figure of beauty. Like, she's powerful. She's, like, you know, Alma talks to her a lot about her past and opens up to the little girl a lot, which you find out, like, later on in the film might have told her a few things that open up the curse a bit more. I don't know. Out in the open, but I think it's really sweet. She like brushes her hair. I don't know.
It's an instant sort of like platonic relationship they have as well, because they instantly get on.
As soon as she sees her, she says, "I want to grow my hair like her."
And again, I think that is with the great thing about this film, the idea is so well, because you were saying about the different generations and what they represent. Yeah. And, you know, this idea that, you know, starting with an open mind, you know, this idea that, you know, bigotry and hate is something that's learned, it's passed down.
Totally. Like, she had the little girl's too young to even know about the history or even have influence from her parents to hate, you know, these indigenous, you know, like, workers in their home. But she just wants to be friends. And that's what the younger generation of today is, that like, call it Gen Z, call it millennials or whatever. I hate, I feel sick saying it.
But we
just want to get along. We're that guy in Mean Girls. We're like, can we just eat a cake of rainbows and just hold hands and just move the fuck on, because we're all too traumatized to just, you know, like, just let us live.
Just let us be.
Yeah.
Let's just all get on. Let's just be. I think that idea, again, in the film, La Llorona represents this kind of, again, I said earlier, like Gaia-like archetype, where it's, you know, Mother Earth. It's this like living, breathing thing. The only way we're going to get through this is, you know, the interconnectedness of everything. Because I feel the family dynamic in the film is a lot like Hereditary. The more the paranormal thing take over, the more into madness the family descend into. And I thought, given different context, totally with both movies, but the same sort of arc with like a family that had a lot of things they didn't talk about, and the supernatural aspect represented the trauma as well as everything else around.
The constant mob outside their house the entire time they're there, and you can hear it in the background noise, like it's constantly this banging, and you can see like people trying to get away from it, like sitting in separate rooms and sort of like taking a moment away, and that is almost like a constant reminder that everybody knows about what's going on, everybody knows what's happening, and they're just choosing to sit there and just like only concentrate on what's affecting them in their little bubble. But it's there, it's in the back of their mind. I can literally hear it. And like, that even builds so much tension throughout the film. Like,
exactly. Cause it's almost like a pathetic fallacy, you know?
It almost doesn't seem real. When I was watching, I was like, that doesn't even look real. Like, this huge fucking crowd. Like, it seems so strange. You're like, no, this is this actually happened, like, even though it's a horror film, but it's, like, based on real events and, like, a real, probably real stories and stuff, but...
It's funny you say that, because I thought there was an element of, like, absurdity to it. Yeah. But it kind of worked, you know, like, the visual metaphor was literally, you know, there was, like you were saying, you know, there's this all this chaos and shouting going on around them, and they're just sitting worrying about what's happening to their genocidal father and not worrying about the real...
actual problem, yeah, exactly. And it's not just the, you know, who's being infected directly in the house. It's everywhere. Like, there's literally thousands of people outside the house like chanting about, and they've got people's faces. I wonder if they were actual... Like, they've got people's faces, like, on posters and ballot bollards and stuff like that. I wonder if they were real victims and people that weren't missing and died. I wonder if that has any link. I don't know. Mm. But that
possibly
was really
bad. It wouldn't surprise me, actually. What did you think of the ending? Oh, really?
I would hate going, I wish... I don't know. I wish, like, it could have just ended a little bit. I don't know why I had to show the guy in the bathroom.
Because that's showing the curse... It's moving on to another general.
I know. Oh, yeah, I know. But, like, I don't know. I was like, it's still good. It's still good. I still love the film.
I love how, like, you kept seeing flashbacks, but throughout, you were wondering, wait, are these flashbacks real? Because you were seeing the grandmother. But then,
she was terrifying.
You understand that the grandmother's being transported. So these are not her memories. These were Alma's memories.
Mm,
but you're seeing it as the grandmother. So it's quite confusing. And then you realise at the end, she's been transported to see Alma's final moments.
I thought that was amazing.
Or La Llorona.
Because it's always switches between, like, obviously the whole film is from the perspective of the general, but then it goes to, like, the grandmother as well.
Mm.
Who is just... I think she just looks terrifying, period. Mm-hmm. Like, she's just a really scary...
Really strong performances from all the actors.
I know... She's got, like, this amazing long grey hair, which was just... I wonder if it's real, but it was just amazing, but...
So I was thinking the exact same thing.
You know?
I was thinking the exact same thing.
Is that, what, 18 inches? I don't know. But...
Because you're not sure at first what's going on with those flashbacks, or later on kind of become memory sequences. And even, you know, and then she sees her husband, you know, drowning the kids, which, again, you know, come 360 with the La Llorona myth. And then in the memory, she strangles... the husband, and then cuts into real time. She's actually strangled him in real life. And again, I thought that image where she's strangling him, that single image brought the whole thing 360 back all the way back around.
Mm.
I think just emphasize how well written and well thought out this film is.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you know what I want to point out? That the fucking Enrique shot his granddaughter in the pool.
Yeah.
I was like, she didn't die. There's no RIPs, of children.
No, no children.
Not. But, yeah. I mean, children do die. Children die.
Oh, but... children do die in this film, yeah. Children,
this whole film's about children dying, actually.
Yes,
but,
yeah, that is true.
Yeah, Alma used the child, like, they kept practicing. Because they keep practicing, they're holding their breath underwater, and you're like,
no, because she is trying to tell her, learn to hold your breath, because if my children knew how to hold their breath, they wouldn't have died because they were drowning them. So she was just like, kept telling, she keeps telling me, don't drown.
But in the final scene, he thinks he's seeing La Llorona, this cursed woman in the pool, and it's his daughter. The family are like, what have you done? What have you done? And then a bunch of dead people or ghosts of dead people just show up in his garden. The head maid is trying to, like, perform some sort of sex ritual to protect the family.
That's what gets really spooky.
Yeah, it's a really great final scene. Well, there's a scene after that, but
see, that's what I mean. The scene after that, you didn't say the final. You called that the final scene. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you're saying. I do know what you mean. I do know what you mean.
Because obviously we know the curse is going on. We know the curse now. We know it. It didn't really, it's like, we get it.
No, but I think if it just ended on him dying, it would just be like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or like ended
the
too early.
The funeral bit was okay.
I like the funeral.
It could have ended at the funeral bit. That could have ended there. But then it's like, oh, homage.
No, but then if it ended on the funeral, it would be like, oh, it's sad. Well, funeral.
Yeah, you're right.
But then they had to give something.
Right.
I know what you mean, because, like, sometimes I'll watch a film where it's like, I don't feel the ending felt satisfying, but it made, like, logical narrative sense. Like, the ending of this reminded me a lot of, was it Satan's Slave.
I haven't seen that.
Saints Blade.
No, no, the Indonesian movie. The same guy that made.
Oh Ezio. Yeah.
What was the
yeah, other? Satan's. I think he called it Satan's Slave.
Satan Slaves.
He called it something.
Yeah, Satan Slaves.
So Satan something. And the ending of the ending of La Llorona reminded me a lot of Satan Slaves. The ending of, which isn't a bad thing, but I thought there were some nice little nods and borrows from stuff like even Onibaba. You know, the fact that this is almost, even though it is a horror film, it's more of a
like a drama.
Like Oni, felt like an art house film, didn't it?
Yeah,
it very much like.
It's
an
so
art
beautifully house. Shot. Yes. Like yes. Honestly, every scene in this film is like.
Art
beautiful,
in of
and also story. Alma, beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. Even though she's supposed to be, you know, La Llorona. Well, it's just like it reminds me a lot of like Solange's like music videos that she did. Don't you think? Like sort of with in a really good way. I like
Solange. I know what you mean.
Like with like when that the scene where she's in the pool, and even like I was reading about like the costume designer as well, and. The thought that she put into her dress is supposed to be really, like, you know, like, flowy and, like, play with the light, with the natural lighting of, like, everything. It was just, like, yeah, like you said earlier, a juicy film.
A juicy film. It was a very juicy film.
Really dive deep into the film.
That was a really deep dive.
I think if we talk about it, we'd literally just be describing the theme at this point.
No, but that's what people do when they talk about a review.
They talk about a review.
Isn't that what people... Well, my audio is from the beginning, right? Yeah. I've never cut it off. It is an hour and 24. And loads of that is us chatting shit, walking around, doing shit, going to the toilet. So it's fine. It just seems long.
Fair. Yeah, to be fair, well, I
can't think of anything else. Can you
think of... I mean, I think credit to the film that we've been talking about it in such depth. For so long, I still feel there's plenty more we could discuss about this film. You were saying it's an art house thing. Again, it reminded me of like a Bergman type thing, where the metaphors and it was all so well thought out, and you could read into. There's so much richness in this film.
It is rich,
much like the two other films we've reviewed as well, but this one I think is almost like the pinnacle.
Why were you saying it's the best out of the three?
I would say it's my favorite out of the three.
Ooh. I think out of all three, I think mine would... I love this film, but I think mine would be Saint Maud.
Is that the Saint Maud or this?
Yeah, it's between these Saint two. Maud more. I love Vivarium, but, like, obviously, it's just had a lot more going on.
Yeah, it's more serious. Yeah. I feel tonally this has got a lot more in common with Saint Maud than... Vivarium's a...
Actually, also, the fact that they highlight, like, that the actress Alma is, I think, from... Like, she's... Is she? I think she's indigenous, or she's like native.
Maria Mercedes Caroy. Yeah. She is indigenous. Yeah.
Like, when do you ever get to see indigenous women in cinema?
This guy, Jairo Bustamante, he has centered indigenous people in his films. His first.
Yeah.
Same actress. Who's the main actress in his first film, Volcano, in its language is called Ixcanol. That was a very popular film in its country, and that centered on an indigenous woman in rural and urban Guatemala. And then his second film is about coming out as gay in Guatemala.
Wow. The film also
mainly is in Mayan as well. So he has centered indigenous voices.
What are they both called?
So the first one is called Ixcanol or Volcano, and the second one is called Tremors.
Oh my God, when you said Tremors, I thought you meant the one with the giant worms on the ground.
No, it's a Guatemalan film. Tremors or Temblores, which was released in the same year, also early 2019.
Oh, wow.
Prolific director. All his films are getting, like, big press in Europe and America.
Well, it's certainly the first Guatemalan film I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's it.
And again, under 100 minutes, 97
minutes.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the history lesson.
Yeah, this has been fun. This has been fun, this.
I like the review series because, obviously, like, when we do it different, when we do it on other things, like, we talk about the film, we can talk about other stuff, but when we talk about it this way, this is why we really like film. Oh, it's interesting to see what all three of us differently pick up on when we watch it and what parts of films like we enjoy, and
we can actually discuss it in like depth.
Yeah, and if other people are interested in that, surely that's why they listen to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. People listening. If you've enjoyed this, like, we'll do it again. Like, let us know, and like, maybe like, well, the guys and girls listening, if they want to pick, sort of, like, I don't know, three films that have something in common.
Well, our previous episode where we picked our three favorite films of the year, they were more under the radar and didn't get that much press. But these films that we for the reviews did get press, did get picked up.
Maud had
incredible critical reception. La La Rona has been nominated for a Golden Globe, might be nominated for Academy Award. But these easily could have made our favourite films, but these did get wider attention.
We were going for the underground for our favourite.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, trying to give some people spotlights that they deserve.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, I feel this kind of highlights where, you know, La La Rona is a horror film, but it's being nominated. Horror was always kind of considered like the scuzzy sort of like bastardized brother of something, you know, like it's really nice to see like real proper filmmakers making like proper horror films. And like for people, you know, I think it's because I feel people who don't even like horror films might like all three of these films we talked about.
Yeah.
Especially La Llorona. Because there's more to it than it being just a horror film.
And if you want to watch this, it's available for free if you have a Shudder account.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Which, get Shudder. I might even put a link to Shudder on one of
them. Do we have an
offer? What would you guys rate it?
I would give it a 5, genuinely. And I was going to give St. Maud a 5, but not this one. I'll easily get a 5 for me.
I agree. I was thinking about it when I took the dog for a walk. I was like, 4 or 5.
I love it.
5.
And I was thinking about it in the shower, and I was thinking, these are serious things that run through my mind. I'm gonna give it a 5. Yeah, 5s. And it's shit that IMDb is like put it a 6 or something. That's shit, man. People don't get it, man.
Well, I feel
maybe it wasn't horror enough. There wasn't enough jump scares for horror fans.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think this is part of like mainstream horror fare at the moment. You know, like shock. Jump scare movies like the Curse of La Llorona. This is a very more art house interpretation of. But yeah, watch it. You can literally watch it for free on Shudder.
Yeah, can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, go watch it.
So what are we doing next time?
So we're gonna have a Mother's Day special.
Oh,
hopefully on Mother's Day. We've been absent a lot of 2021, so we're coming with fresh, more content for you this week.
Coming in hard.
Yeah, yes. And we'll try to work faster than we have in the previous months.
What films are we doing? Are we not going to tell them?
We're not going to tell them.
Yeah.
Ah.
They haven't found out.
Tune in till Mother's Day and find out.
Watch it with your mother. Listen it to, you know. Maybe we'll release it before Mother's Day so you can, you know what films to watch with your mum that day.
Mother's Day. You don't have to buy her anything. You just tell her to listen to this.
Stream this.
Do everyone a favour.
No. Don't do that. That's bad advice.
All right. Well, thank you so much, people, for listening. I hope you've really enjoyed this as much as we have. Thank you for the support. Until next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Ensangrentada. Todos lloraban tu tierra ensangrentada. Sollozos de un pueblo herido, llorona, y de su voz silenciada. Sollozos de un pueblo herido, llorona, y de su voz silenciada. No sé qué tienen las flores, llorona, las flores del Campo Santo. sé qué tienen las flores, llorona, las flores del campo santo, que cuando las mueve el viento, llorona, parece que están llorando. Lava tu tus penas, llorona, llorona, con agua bendita del río. Convierte tu angustia en calma, llorona, y la madrugada en rocío. Convierte tu angustia en calma, llorona, y la madrugada en rocío.